A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Welcome to the History of the Saints podcast. My name is Glenn Rawson, series host. What you are about to listen to is an episode about the documentary history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This episode is one of more than 250 presentations from 1805 and the birth of Joseph Smith the prophet through 1877 and the death of Brigham Young. This series interviews some of the finest scholars of our time and presents the latest in historical research and facts as it relates to early Latter-day Saint history. And it comes from the long-running, highly acclaimed television documentary series, History of the Saints. If you have a desire to learn the history in depth and detail, then this podcast is for you. Thank you for joining us.
Martin would say that he was raised up for this purpose, that his success as a farmer and as a businessman was to help the boy Joseph Smith.
In August of 1829, Martin Harris, a prosperous Palmyra farmer, offered his farm to Egbert B. Grandin, a printer in Palmyra, to secure the costs of printing the Book of Mormon, 5,000 copies for $3,000. And in the end, the book was printed, and it cost Martin his farm, all of it. This is that story, the story of Martin Harris and the printing of the Book of Mormon.
Martin Harris, they say, was not just a good farmer. He was a great farmer. And I believe he came by it honestly. He came from a family of farmers all the way back from Kent County in Old England. His family would arrive in America as Quakers in the 17th century, initially settling in Massachusetts. He learned farming from his father. The old adage about farmers is if your dad is a good farmer, you learn to be a farmer not just like your dad, but exactly like your dad. And so he was schooled by a great farmer, Nathan Harris. Nathan Harris would pick Palmyra to buy his property in that purchase. Why? Many would say because it was the finest farmland in all of the land available. He would buy approximately 600 acres, 1 mile by approximately 1 mile, just north of the city of Palmyra.
Nathan Harris eventually sold off portions of that property, some of it to his sons. And with what he had left, he made a beautiful farm.
Not everyone is born to be a farmer, and even fewer who thought they were would do it successfully. And records indicate that almost 30% of all families that came into Palmyra stayed only a couple years, tried farming, and then moved on. The exceptions were people like the Harrises, who came and settled and became very successful farmers.
In 1808, Martin married his first cousin, Lucy Harris, and then began to accumulate property. Over time, he became a well-respected member of the community.
I would say in so many regards, she was a critical component of his success. It took a very strong wife to be married to a farmer, and even more so in those days, where it would take years of toil to put together a homestead that was truly admirable. Martin, just shortly after his marriage, would acquire his first large piece of ground from his father, 121 acres. He would add to that in the ensuing years, so he had a farm of about a little shy of 235 acres. He also bought 4 acres of downtown property of lots, And so clearly looking to buy those for investment purposes. Many people in the community would say that the Martin and Lucy Harris family were a very respected and hardworking, successful, prosperous farming family. And that would continue for years.
We know that the marriage of Martin and Lucy Harris came apart. It has been assumed by some that that was because of Martin's involvement with Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. However, the documents reveal that that marriage was in trouble well before Martin knew Joseph.
There are indications of it as early as in the 1820s, but by 1825, it appears that they had reached a point where they decided to make a formal decision about their marriage. In the early 19th century, the only basis for a divorce would be adultery. And there's no indication that that would be a reason that they could use for a divorce. And consequently, they would have to enter into some sort of settlement or partial divorce. And the records, now that we look at them, really appear to indicate that by 1825, they were very engaged in that process.
Even then, the law recognized a wife's legal claim on her husband's property.
So in 1825, this marriage is frayed, and they made a decision to do a jointure, meaning they're going to do a partial divorce or a property settlement. And what it's going to require is them to look at the property that they then own, or that Martin owns at that time, and determine what portion of it would be Lucy's dower interest. And at that point in time, they owned between 235 and 240 acres. So her one-third interest would be how many acres? 80. And so this jointure occurs.
In the end, Lucy got clear title to the 80 acres on which the main house stood, while Martin received approximately 151 acres, free and clear of all encumbrances. And again, this was all before Martin knew Joseph Smith Jr.
We have the deeds. And so when you plot the deeds, you can find exactly what part of the farm she got. And so what we know is she got the north end of that farm, that 80-acre piece across the top of the farm. But we also know from our research that is where the family home was built. So it made the most sense that what Martin was deeding to his wife was not just a third, but maybe the most valuable third of the farm where actually the home was. There was also a second home built further, a smaller home, almost like a worker's home on the property. When Martin gets back home, they're separated. She's living in the main house. He's living in the small house.
Martin Harris began as a friend of Father Smith, but by 1827, he was well acquainted with Joseph Jr. and the gold plates.
One interesting footnote, going back to when Joseph first receives the plates, he goes to Martin and says to Martin Harris, who is, 44 years old at the time, so he's, 20 years older than Joseph, and says something to the effect, "I've looked into the stones," meaning the Urim and Thummim, "and I saw you. And I was told that you would help with both the translation and the printing of the book." And Martin says, "If the Lord will reveal to me that that is his will, I will give you anything and everything I have to fulfill it." And Martin will later write that a short time thereafter, he says, "The Lord did impress on my mind that it was his will for me to aid Joseph Smith." You see, I think Martin understood that, and matter of fact would say, that he was raised up for this purpose, that his success as a farmer and as a businessman was to help the boy Joseph Smith.
Perhaps it was motivated by this conviction that caused Martin to do so much for Joseph and the work. He helped Joseph and Emma move to Pennsylvania. He carried the characters back to New York to Charles Anthon and thereby fulfilled prophecy. He spent months scribing for Joseph with the 116 pages of manuscript. And with regard to that lost manuscript, given what we know about the troubled state of his marriage, is it any wonder then that Martin so earnestly wanted to show that manuscript to Lucy?
The stories make sense about that, the tension that had already existed between Martin and Lucy because of these events that happened all the way back into 1825. And they're rearing their heads again here When Martin is reaching out, trying to, you know, think about what the purpose of him taking the 116 pages was. It was to bring his family back together. And so I have a lot of empathy toward it going so terribly bad for him, because I think there were such good reasons why a good man wants to share the most important things in his life to those that he cares most about. And so he's trying to make that happen.
Notwithstanding his past mistakes, Martin repented. He humbled himself, and the Lord trusted him to become one of the three special witnesses of the Book of Mormon.
A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
When it came time to print the Book of Mormon, Mother Smith said that the original agreement was for Martin to pay half, and Joseph and Hiram would pay the other half. Martin secured his portion by the mortgage on his farm.
And unfortunately, how we think of a mortgage today is different than how it's being used in this context. Because in a mortgage today, if I was going to get a mortgage on my home, I would go to a bank. They would appraise the home. They would give me then a percentage of the value of the home, 80%, 90% in cash. Then I could give to the person I'm buying it for. So the buyer gets cash. The bank gets a lien on my home, and I pay money to the bank. That's a mortgage. While we call it a mortgage in the 19th century, what it really is that it was collateral, that it was underwritten, or it was secured, payment was secured by a piece of property. They had 18 months from the date of August 1829 before that collateral could be used. The goal was that within that 18 months, enough books would sell that they could then pay that $3,000 obligation to Grandin. And if you think about it, they initially thought they were going to sell the books at $1.75 a piece. Then in short order, they reduced that to $1.25 a piece. That being the case, they would need to sell about half of the books, 2,400 of the 5,000, to cover that $3,000 obligation.
It was during this time that a revelation was received. We know it today as Section 19 of the Doctrine and Covenants. In it, the Lord gave this commandment to Martin Harris.
Impart a portion of thy property, yea, even part of thy lands, and all save the support of thy family. Pay the debt thou hast contracted with the printer. Release thyself from bondage.
And what is that property? In 1825, when they had the jointure and they did their separation, and Lucy got her 80 acres, the 151 acres was what was left that Martin had free and clear. Why was that important? Well, by 1829 in August, after the Lord's given a command that Martin Harris is to give freely of his property for underwriting the printing of the Book of Mormon, had that jointure not taken place, Martin would have been required to get Lucy Harris's approval to pledge that ground, because no one is going to take the ground with Lucy Harris's dower interest still sitting on it. And what do you think the chances that Lucy Harris at that point would have agreed to allow Martin to use that last piece of his property, what he had left, to collateralize the Book of Mormon? I think it would never have happened. So in some providential way, before Martin even knew the Smiths, knew Joseph Smith Jr., was engaged in the process, things had been put in motion. So when Martin would be called upon to give his property for the printing, he indeed had uniquely separate property sufficient to pledge to Grandin so that Grandin would print the Book of Mormon. And he could do that without ever having Lucy's approval.
And Martin signed over the entirety of his farm. all 151 acres.
I can scarcely imagine the deep breath that Martin had to take to put his name down. And in some ways, I believe, Glenn, it was that moment that Martin secured his place in the hereafter. Because few of us are ever asked to put it all on the altar. And at that moment, by revelation, Martin was asked to do so. And the truth is, it's exactly what he did. Most people would argue that after 1829, he was never again a successful farmer or a businessman. Almost proof positive of his belief that he was raised up to do this singular act. Now, would that mean he wouldn't work hard to see if he could salvage some of it, sell the books? We know he aggressively tried. He aggressively tried to sell books because he knew that would maybe means that maybe not the whole 150 have to get sold. Maybe he could get away with just selling part of it. And maybe that could be going down smaller and smaller. But the truth is that it was all on the line.
By August of 1829, printing was underway and Grandin was legally secure for the entire $3,000.
Grandin also knew that he really didn't need to rely on the sale of the book. He needed to hold out for 18 months and he was going to be able to get Martin to pay the rest of it. That is why I think he let Abner Cole, you remember Abner Cole, who was a small-time printer that used part-time one day a week or whatever of Grandin's printing operations to print his own little newspaper. And how when he's up there on, I guess, Sunday afternoons printing away, he sees pieces of the Book of Mormon. He starts using that in his newspaper. And the whole issue about Abner Cole getting access to those pages and then having kind of Grandin kind of passively allow that to happen, you know, it seems to indicate that Grandin was always looking at Martin Harris as the financing arm of this venture and not looking ever, which was a smart move, never looking at the sales of the book to generate the income to compensate him that $3,000.
But then in January of 1830, the citizens of Palmyra boycotted the coming book. Grandin stopped printing. But why? What would have been his concern? He was legally secured.
Grandin is starting to feel like, well, if it's totally boycotted, am I going to have to wait all the way for 18 months to do anything? Because remember, at the 18 months, what it allows him to do is to foreclose on the property and find a buyer for the property. And then what if he has to finance the buying on that property? And it might take another period of time before he ever realizes some money. And so you see that he starts being concerned that this is maybe a problem. And he threatens to stop the printing. And Joseph comes up to have a discussion with Grandin on it. And we know that he then deals with the Abner Cole issue is coming up, that Abner is actually stealing part of it. And Joseph is saying, you know, you could be creating part of your own problem. But Grandin, we have a deal. Martin's property secures this transaction. And I expect you to live up to your side of the deal, just as we all expect Martin will live up to his. And so we know at that point in time that Grandin then continues the printing to completion.
March of 1830, the Book of Mormon came off the presses and sure enough, it did not sell well. Joseph Knight recorded this experience.
I went with my team and took Joseph out to Manchester to his father. Now when we got near to his father's, we saw a man some 80 rods before us run across the street with a bundle in his hand. There, says Joseph, there's Martin going across the road with something in his hand. When we came up, it was Martin with a bunch of Mormon books. He came to us and after compliments, he says, the books will not sell for nobody wants them. Joseph said, I think they will sell well, says he. I want a commandment. Why, says Joseph, fulfill what you have got. But, says he, I must have a commandment. Joseph Knight, Sr.
Indeed, Martin had pledged his farm to the cause, but that didn't mean he wanted to lose it. So, of course, he was out trying to sell books, and when they didn't sell, he began to realize this may cost him everything.
And even Grandin gets cold feet because by October of 1830, he decides to sell that collateral or that mortgage to a third party. And he's going to sell it to Thomas Rogers, a relative, I think, of his wife's. And he sells that obligation, meaning that $3,000 commitment is going to be paid either by the sale of the books or by Martin's farm. That agreement he sells, and he sells it to Rogers for $2,000. And so by October of 1830, which knowing that the 18 months won't run until February of 31, so he's months, you know, earlier, he has now sold it for $2,000. I will say just parenthetically as an observation that after the October sale to Rogers $2,000, Grandin does build a new home in Palmyra. So clearly he wasn't financially crippled.
Thomas Rogers now held the note for Martin's farm. In February of 1831, the 18 months were up, and accordingly, Martin sold his farm.
Thomas Lakey is a friend of Martin's. It's a friendly sale. Because I, at the end of the day, I think Thomas Lakey is saying that's a pretty good price. 151 acres of the finest farm in Palmyra for $3,000. And so Martin then has the $3,000 to pay to Rogers and satisfies the obligation. He put on the altar all he had. And those of us who spend much of our time acquiring things and liking what we have, we're asked to give little. None of us, I think, have been asked to give all. But for Martin, his legacy is he was asked to give all. By placing section 19 in its proper context in the summer of 29, we learn that the Lord again addressed Martin specifically, not as the wicked man, but as the man who, if faithful, would be the cause for the printing of the Book of Mormon. And to that responsibility, Martin fully succeeded. And while we may want to handpick all the things that went into it, from the grand councils of heaven looking down, I can only imagine they saw one thing, and that is, he did it. He pledged the farm. He sold the farm. He paid the debt. And for that, he earned his place. And so when the church finally brought an old, tattered man from Ohio out west, he still bore that testimony. He still had that respect that the entire church could give him. Unfortunately, most of us today could just as readily paint him as a villain than a hero. But we brought him out west so that we could have a place to always honor the hero. That's what his monument stands for.
Martin Harris would give not only his personal fortune in 1831, but he would give the rest of his life. To his dying breath, 44 years later, Martin would bear a fervent and burning testimony to the divinity of the Book of Mormon. I'm Glenn Rawson, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information on what you have listened to, please go to historyofthesaints.org. The History of the Saints team that produced this podcast has also produced numerous books and full-length documentaries on early Latter-day Saint church history and the key figures that made that history. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast of History of the Saints has been produced by Dennis Lyman and Glenn Rawson. History of the Saints is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.